Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're off! That's me shouting over Natalie to make sure that she knows that we are off.
Also, what we're just saying is probably libelous, so we should draw a veil.
Have you got any pens?
Yes!
Oh, no. Come on! We are right off! That is number one on my top five list of jokes that we do on Fan Club. How's list off going?
It's good, yeah. It's good. It feels like we've done... I mean, we're desperately trying to do one a week, even though it's... it's difficult, and I think it will be.
Why is it difficult?
Just sort of always difficult to find time. This is easier because we have a set time, I think. So every
Why haven't you learned from this and applied it to your?
Well, as I'm saying it out loud, it's occurred to me. Do you know what we should do? We should just have a set time.
Yeah.
Rather than just let it drift and then go, oh, I need to do another one. I need to do another one now.
What you could do is you could do it Wednesdays at 4:30.
Could do, and then that'd be my day for doing podcast recordings.
Or you could list off.
I'm saying this; it sounds like I'm publicising it, but Natalie has pointed out I should say what it is, because List Off is a podcast to do with my friend Ozzy, where we list top five things, and it can be basically anything, absolutely anything. We have to come up with five of our favourite examples of that thing.
Have I met Ozzy?
You have met him a couple of times at things like my birthday and things like that.
I feel like I've met Ozzy.
Definitely.
But then I don't recognise him on the picture. So I'm just sort of like, I know I've met him. I know I have, but yeah. Anyway, that's not like, I'm not being rude. What is that? I just found the longest. Oh, it's not mine. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, I was going to say, it's probably not yours.
I thought it was one of my grey hairs, but it wasn't. It was, anyway. So, right. So, yeah, every week. You could also do it at 12, couldn't you, on a Wednesday?
Record
it. Yeah, and then you've done it, and then how long does it take to record? An hour and a half?
About an hour and a half, yeah. They're usually about an hour 20 we've worked out, where we tend to be. For some reason, they're always almost exactly the same time every week.
And then grab a snack, and then come back and do Fan Club.
I know. As I'm saying this out loud, it does make sense to just...
That's just what I would do. I would schedule it so that you're all doing it all in one go. And that way, you know, you can spend the rest of the week, you know, your time, just what you want. I don't know why we started. Welcome to Fan Club. So that's you're listening to FUBAR Radio, and we are fucked up beyond all recognition. This is Fan Club, where you want fucked up, we'll give you fucked up. We're going to list all of the Police Academy films in the order that we saw them, and then the order of preference.
Yeah.
Me.
Get used to it.
Four, three, six, five, seven, one.
You saw one last?
I was just doing random numbers. It was just a bit of a skit more than anything. But you're listening to FUBAR Radio. We are fucked up beyond all recognition. So anyway, what John Carpenter films have you seen this week? Whoa, fucked up. That is so fucked up, man. My name is Nick Helm. As if I needed any introduction, but you might need a little bit of help.
not on the tip of your tongue. Give another look. No, it's not who you thought it might be. It is, in fact, Nathaniel Metcalf. Hello.
It's Nathaniel Metcalf. Hello. And what's the first rule of fan club? Tell your friends about fan club. Second rule of fan club, please just tell them. Well, keep a good secret to yourself. That's what I always say. Do we have any statistics on where we are in any charts this week? No, it doesn't look like it.
It doesn't look like we do, which suggests either Natalie hasn't checked or, well, as I suspected, we're not charting this week in any territory.
Or we're doing so well that we probably don't need to talk about it.
Yeah. So now, wherever you are in the world, I mean, we can't tell you to listen if you're nowhere in the world.
That's my point. They're listening. Don't worry. And guys, let me be the first to say thanks for listening. And by first, I mean ever. So, how are you? I've forgotten how to do this.
I know, I'm quite enjoying it.
Is that what
we're doing? Enjoying it. You say, what have I been a fan of this
how
week?
How are you?
Oh, I'm all right.
Hey, Nathaniel. Mm-hmm. Hey, Nathaniel, I've got a question. Yeah. What have you been a fan of this week?
Good question. I'll tell you what I did see.
Well, Richard Donner died yesterday.
Yeah. That is sad. I didn't realise he was 91. And, 91.
I didn't realise he was 91. Of course, when you find that out, it does make perfect sense.
Of course it does, when you go back. But when you hear it, you go, that's crazy. And then you go,
because he didn't look like a teenager when he was directing Superman in those behind-the-scenes shots from 1978 or whenever it was. 78 or 79?
78.
Yes. Of course, Alien was 79. Star Wars 77, Jaws 75. So, of course. Poltergeist 81. So, of course he was 91. And also he hasn't made a film for like a very long time.
Yeah.
And I'm always really surprised when I look up. I thought Lethal Weapon 4 was a belated sequel, you know.
Yeah.
By that I mean like 10 years later. So when was Lethal Weapon 3? 92, 93?
I think it was 92, and I reckon... Yeah, what year is Lethal Weapon 4 going to be?
I think it's 97.
And, I like
97? No, I think it was 98, actually. Batman and Robin and Lost World was 97. I think it was the year after. But it feels like... I always thought it was in the 2000s, like they had to be dragged back out of retirement and foster. But it was, and so when I, because I hadn't seen, I think I've seen bits of Lethal Weapon 4, but not all. It's not a good film. But
I think really Lethal Weapon is, you've got one, and you've got two sort of, and that's it really.
I remember 3, and I like 3, and I've always remembered the bad guy from 3, which is a sign of a fairly good bad guy.
Who is the bad guy?
He's the same guy that plays the bad guy in Mask of Zorro, and he plays a Mexican in Mask of Zorro. Ah. So it's a little bit problematic when you look at it through modern eyes, but. Yeah, I can't remember his name. Is it like Joseph Gans? Or is that the name of... That might be the name of some sort of... Anyway, God from... Anyway, let's carry on. can we look up the bad guy? Oh, look, she's done it. Oh, wow. Not charting this week. Oh, that's not quite what I was wanting to know. You could have lied to us. What is the name of the guy who plays the bad guy in... Mask of Zorro, or is it Mark of Zorro is the sequel, right?
Yes.
Mask of Zorro and Lethal Weapon 3. Anyway, it's easy to forget. Richard Donner. Superman is a film that I brush over. I don't rewatch it. That Stuart Wilson. Stuart Wilson. Fuck off. Is his name Stuart Wilson? He's got a moustache and he looks like a very boring kind of like middle aged kind of guy. And he's the bad guy. They have these armor-piercing bullets that that they're using in Lethal Weapon 3. But it's kind of like, so Superman is a film that obviously I grew up with. I think Superman's biggest contribution to me is Christopher Reeve. And when I was little, those first three films, I think, what, Superman 4 came out in 87 or something.
Yeah.
And I think I was sort of grown, I was aware of what, I didn't go and see Superman 4 at the cinema. I remember there being some sort of display. There was a flying car with Superman, and, well, Superman was lifting up a car in Hamleys or in, right, in some sort of shop window in London. Maybe it was the toy shop. What's that one?
That is Hamleys.
Selfridges?
Oh,
but I think it might have been Selfridges.
Oh, maybe. Okay.
So there was one of those big shops in London, and I think my mum took us to look through the window. There was the car with Gene Hackman and John Cryer in it, and Christopher Reeve, Superman, sort of like flying it off. I guess they were free that morning. So good for them for rolling their sleeves up and marking in. But I still don't think I've seen all of Superman 4 all the way through. But the first three are all sort of like moulded together in a way. So the first one, I have seen it. The music's obviously iconic. And, you know, there's so much great about Superman. But when it actually comes to sitting down and watching Superman, I'm kind of a little bit like, yeah.
I think Superman is like, I think it's a frustrating film because it's, I think it really stands up the whole thing, and it's so close to being like just about perfect, apart from the kind of going back in time, the sort of fake ending they put on it. And that's like the worst bit about it. You go, ah, it's such a shame. Everything else I think is perfect up to that point.
All the, I don't mind that.
I think are spot on.
Yeah. The performance is incredible. Margaret Kidder, you know, the guy that plays Perry White, like, everyone is great in it, right? Who's the guy that plays Jimmy Olsen?
He's Mark McClure.
I thought he was such a huge star.
So did I. Know?
And then you go, oh, he was in those. He was in Amazon Women on the Moon. And then years later, he plays one character in Joss Whedon's Justice League and another character in Zack Snyder's Justice League.
And he's in the thing, isn't he? He's in Back to the Future. So because he's in these big
course,
movies,
yes,
you think like, oh, that guy is huge. How did they get him? and he's like, he hasn't done anything else. That's it.
The career making performance of Jimmy Olsen and then Martin McFly's nameless brother.
7 years later.
And then in the Russ Meyer sequence in Amazon Women on the Moon, and then that is it. But as a kid, I thought, fucking hell, this guy, this is like the Expendables. They've got all of these guys. They've got, you know, when you watch Superman 1 as a kid, you go, can't believe it. They've got all of these guys from Superman 2 in it. It's amazing. How do they get them? I know what you mean. Do you know what? It's the beginning bit with when they do kind of like the origin story, when it's not Christopher Reeve and it's this kid wearing this wig.
Yes.
And he doesn't look young enough for it not to be played by Christopher Reeve.
Exactly. This guy looks no younger than Christopher Reeve does.
Did you see the Haunting of Hill House?
No. I started watching it.
I think it was really good, except for it falls apart in the last episode. We got Henry Thomas to play a young version of Timothy Hutton. And you go, there's like 7 years difference. It's like, there's no difference. Like, just age Timothy Hutton up or age Henry Thomas up, right? But don't have two guys that don't really look that much like each other, having played in age groups, you know? But, it was the origin bit where it's not Christopher Reeve, and you're kind of getting Chris off when he gets to Metropolis. The beginning with Marlon Brando is great. And then when he gets to Metropolis, that's great. And all the stuff in Smallville is a little bit like, yeah. And sort of like, it really comes alive when Ned Beatty and Gene Hackman show up, and you're kind of like, great, right? So I obviously, you know, I would say Superman is a 5-star, you know, gold standard movie. It's up there with Star Wars, Back to the Future, all those films. It's just a film that I don't, you know, I don't particularly enjoy getting through, right? And I can watch Back to the Future anytime. I can watch Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back anytime. And Superman feels like it's a little bit of like, it feels like it is setting up a franchise or setting up a story. It feels like there's a lot of setup to get that out of the way in order for them to have made like a bunch of films. Whereas Back to the Future feels like self-contained. Star Wars feels self-contained. Although I guess if you have any complaints about Star Wars, knowing now what you know, whatever the phrase is, if you knew then what you know now, is that there is a lot of setup with Luke Skywalker on Tatooine, standing in the sand, looking at stuff. But then again, last time I saw Star Wars and Luke Skywalker's looking up at the twin suns, you know, it's, and with the music, it's sort of that can bring, not me, I'm not saying me, but that can bring like a grown man or woman to tears. But not, I didn't, but like, I imagine that you could cry if you were like in a vulnerable place, you know, mentally. So Superman deserves to be amongst all those things, but for me, it's not like, it doesn't have to rewatch. So even something like Superman 3 has, where it's like, let's cut the bullshit and get straight to it. I'm going off on a tangent, but what I really want to say is like, so you've got Superman, which is a film that I subconsciously sort of dismiss. It's never, out of all the Supermen, even though the others are far more flawed, it's not the one that I go to. And then you've got The Omen, which I think is great. And it's kind of like, you got, there was The Exorcist, which was like, there's, you know, it's a horror movie that is trying to be kind of fairly realistic, that is dealing with Catholic priests fighting Satan, right? But it's sort of like this 70s, New Hollywood kind of approach to it, where it's sort of gritty and real. And then based off that was success that Richard Donner made The Omen, and then The Omen is kind of like, you know, it ended up to be the first in a franchise, which I think is actually, the Omen franchise is actually a really good franchise. But The Omen is kind of like, feels like a popcorn. It's like a middle, it's like a middleman between it being an all out exploitative popcorn movie and it being, you know, it's got one foot in The Exorcist and one foot in something else, right? Jaws.
It does. I think it's, and it's also got one foot in like Hammer horror. It has that sort of, it's all those kind of British actors, but doing it almost like, this is what Hammer should have done in the 70s. They should have tried to move with the times a bit. It really does feel like it almost acknowledges that stuff, but does it in a sort of 70s way. Whereas The Exorcist feels like something else entirely. That's why
The Exorcist feels like, it feels like one of them New York movies, like a Scorsese or, you know, and it's like, and it feels so sort of gritty and real. There's no, even though there's ridiculous stuff that happens in The Exorcist, it's not a fun film, you know, and it's not trying to be a fun film. Whereas The Omen has these ridiculous kind of like deaths, and it's almost like Final Destination in a way, where you're waiting for this thing to happen. I think The Omen is this great film, but again, it's not this film that I revisit loads. The Goonies, I never got on with The Goonies.
I loved it as a kid, but it's just, and I don't think I've seen it as an adult. But I, like, my brain is like going, nah, don't watch that anymore. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to watch it. I remember enjoying it a lot.
I hated it as a kid because I used to get bullied at school. I was overweight. And if it was on like a Saturday, on Monday, they'd all sort of bully me with Goonie stuff, and I was like, oh right. So I really hated it. And then I also like, when I was a kid, my dream was to be Indiana Jones. It wasn't to be like another kid that was pretending to be Indiana Jones. I didn't need to see another kid, you know, and I didn't want to be, which one was he, which one does the truffle shuffle?
Chunk.
I did not want to be Chunk. So I didn't want to, do you know what I mean? It was just like, I don't want to be part of the Goonies gang. Yeah. I don't want to. I think Lost Boys was meant to be like the Goonies, wasn't it? They were all meant to be the Goonies age, and then they aged them up a bit. And then Lethal Weapon. And Lethal Weapon, absolutely. Like, before Die Hard, Lethal Weapon kind of set the blueprint of how you do an action film. You get mismatched buddy cops. So I wrote a post on Instagram, and it's easy to just sort of like look at that. And then he did Lady Hawk, and I really loved Assassins when I saw it at the cinema. I can't remember if I went by myself or not, but it was one of those films where Stallone versus Banderas, and I was very naive at the time, and I honestly didn't know which way it was going to go, you know. Fighting each other, and
I went to see Assassins at the cinema, and I don't think it was a big deal, but it was a big deal when I saw it. Do you know what I mean? I remember really looking forward to it. It's almost like, they've got the guy from Desperado and the guy, it's and Stallone in a movie, brilliant, amazing.
I think, but also what people don't realise, right, is that growing up through the 80s, Stallone was kind of a big deal, but I never watched any Stallone films. And Rambo was like an 18, or Rambo 2 and Rambo 3 were 18s. And so in the video shop, there was kind of like this aura of fear around them, just like, that's an 18. So imagine the things that you will see in that film. They will, you know, they will haunt you forever if you see these 18 certificate Stallone films. By the time you get to the 90s, where he was sort of like staging his comeback, where he'd just sort of like, he'd done Stop on My Mum Will Shoot at the beginning of the 90s and Oscar, which sort of like ended his career for a bit. And then he picked himself up and he did Cliffhanger, Demolition Man in 1993. And then every year he would do a film. And it was like every year, unlike Schwarzenegger, who would do like a tentpole every 2 years or so, and Bruce Willis wasn't ever in the same league if he wasn't doing a Die Hard, then you'd have... And Bruce Willis was doing other stuff like 12 Monkeys, where he was doing proper acting. Whereas if you wanted like Wham Bam, Thank You Ma'am, Bang for Your Bucks entertainment, then you'd have like Stallone or Schwarzenegger. And then if you were really desperate, you know, there'd be an executive decision or something every so often, and you go, oh God, well, it's all right, he dies near the beginning. So if you look at Stallone, you'd have like a new one every summer, or, you know, and so there was Cliffhanger, Demolition Man, Assassins, Judge Dredd, The Specialist, Daylight, you know, and they were like every year he'd come along and it'd be, and I used to fucking absolutely love those Stallone movies because I was always a Schwarzenegger fan. But in the 90s, I could always go to the cinema and watch the Stallone film.
It's true, like, for me, those... Because there was something illicit about those movies, yeah, that were, like, 18s. I think I caught them all when they kind of started appearing on TV. But, like, when they were, like, videos, it was like I wasn't allowed to watch those movies. But when I was, like, 13, 14, it's like they started making, I guess, more mainstream movies that were suddenly just much more accessible to all ages. I mean, Lethal Weapon's a good example. Lethal Weapon's an 18. That was a film that I remember growing up and being a bit like, can't wait till I'm old enough to watch Lethal Weapon. But now it doesn't feel
Lethal
like...
Weapon 2.
Yeah.
With Lethal Weapon 2, there was a bit where there was a bomb on the toilet, and I heard about that in a playground before I saw it, and it sounded terrifying, like absolutely terrifying. So what, he sits on the toilet and there's a bomb on it, and then does it blow up? And they go, yeah, it blows up and the toilet smashes through the window and it lands on a police car. And they don't tell me, it's spoilers, but they didn't tell me that Danny Glover got off the toilet. I just assumed that he died sitting on the toilet. And I was like, it's terrifying. But, you know, I think it's easy to think. You see all these films. So there was Lady Hawk in the 80s. Maverick... I love Maverick. I think it's got one of the best opening lines to any film ever made. He's such a dick, you know, because Mel Gibson was one of the most charismatic, easygoing, most watchable movie stars. You know, he had like he could do. He was kind of like he had like the appeal of a Bruce Willis, where he's like in good shape. He's in good shape, but he's not Schwarzenegger, you know. And so he's sort of relatable, and he's got a great sense of humour, and he can act.
And
so
there's something about his, I guess, his Australianness that gave him a kind of easy charm. So he wasn't kind of, he didn't feel like he was from Hollywood. He felt like he was kind of from somewhere else, and he was a bit more easygoing. He has a lot of charm. That's what he was like, you know, he's a charming everyman kind of character in those films.
Yeah, in those films, in most of the films he made in the 90s, and then he made King Theory with John Lennon. But Maverick is great. But also, it's got like Jodie Foster's brilliant in it. It's kind of like you think of Jodie Foster as a very serious actress, and she is, and she's great in all those things. But at the same time, she was so good at light comedy, and she's brilliant in Maverick. And James Garner's in it, and I love James Garner. He's my favorite. I think James Garner's cooler than Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. I think James Garner is the best. Then you've got James Coburn as well, who's like absolutely fucking, and you've got Graham Greene, who's sort of like doing a pastiche on his Dances with Wolves character. And then you've got this cameo from Danny Glover where they have the Lethal Weapon music. And I think Maverick is a brilliant film. I think its problem is that it's overlong. It outstays its welcome a little bit. But I thought it was a great film. But it's easy to just sort of like go, well, Richard Donner, what did he do? And then you look back and you go, he did an entry in most, you know. So The Omen, he kind of like, The Exorcist could have been a one-off. But when he did The Omen, it was like, no, you can make something that is more commercial and more entertaining and more fun than The Exorcist for a wider appeal. Mm. And it's still creepy. So he nailed like he was the first person after The Exorcist in a way to say, we'll take The Exorcist and we'll do something else with it. Right.
Yeah.
And so he made The Omen. Right. And then you go, right, what else? He did Superman, which is the first serious proper superhero movie, and that is all we get in cinemas, really.
Yeah,
like 90% of all blockbusters are superhero movies, and it's largely thanks to Richard Donner showing people that they could do it. And it, for some reason, there was 4 Superman films, but it took 10 years to get around to Batman, you know. And then there were like, you know, and then it took another 10 years to get to X-Men and Spider-Man. And so it's just kind of like, why was it so slow when the blueprint is still the same? It's Superman is what they use. And then you go, right, Goonies was an adventure film. It was a kids movie. It was the Spielberg film that Spielberg didn't direct, you know, aside from Poltergeist. And it's kind of like, again, he sort of like absolutely defined what a kids film was. And then you have Lethal Weapon, where you look at Fast and the Furious now, and it's about people that, you know, hate each other but are forced to work with each other. You look at Hobbs and Shaw, you look at Vin Diesel and Paul Walker in the first one. That is the, you know, all the Rush Hour movies.
It's all like, what he's doing is it's like he's taking B movies and making A movies out of them.
He's defining genres, you know. Mm. Like, if it wasn't a Die Hard clone, where it's like Under Siege, Steven Seagal's on a boat, yeah, it was a Lethal Weapon clone.
Which are all like those 70s buddy cop movies, Freebie and the Bean and all that kind of stuff, but done, instead of doing it like low budget, you do like,
yeah, right,
do it big budget version of it. Yeah. Do the A movie, yeah, version of it for a mainstream audience.
Yeah, and then after that, you've got like Red Heat, where you have a Russian and an American, and you have Turner and Hooch, where you have like Tom Hanks and a. you got Red Heat, where you got a Russian and Jim Belushi. You've got K9, where you got a dog and Jim Belushi. You've got Filofax, where you've got a Filofax and Jim Belushi. You know, it's weird, isn't it, when they made Blues Brothers 2000 that they didn't ask Jim Belushi, right? Is he in it?
Yeah, I think he's in it. Never seen it. I'm pretty sure he's in it, though, right?
They got John Goodman as the John Belushi replacement. He goes, you got Jim Belushi, right? Don't you own a bar with him? Was he not available? Couldn't you have changed shooting dates? What? What?
I thought he was in it. I've never seen it. I've never seen it, really.
To be fair, I've never seen it. It no, might be either. Worth watching just for sort of like the Aretha Franklin bits and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know. Anyway, the point is that you look, you think, well, what did Richard Donner do? And you think, like, well, he did the Lethal Weapon films. And you think, well, so he was an action guy, was he? And you go, well, he did The Omen. And you go, oh, so he did horror. And you go, yeah, but he also did Superman. But he invented the superhero movie, like the structure, the origin story. Yeah, yeah, but he also did Lady Hawk. So what? He did fantasy, but he did the Goonies. So he did kids. Well, not like that. And then he did Maverick. What? He did fucking, he did a Western, right? And it was, but it wasn't just a Western. It was a spin-off from an old TV series, which sort of paid tribute to the TV series whilst being its own thing, yeah. You know? He nailed absolutely everything, and his. I think you think of George Lucas, you think of Steven Spielberg, but when you look at the films that are out at the moment, you know, the films that come back every year, I would say, arguably, once you get over the spectacle of Spielberg and the set pieces, I would say he's probably one of the most influential directors.
Yeah, when we talk about him that way, it's really surprising we don't talk about him in the same breath as those. Because he's successful, super successful, and he kind of did what those guys did and kind of at the same time, but he doesn't feel like he's part of that gang. And yet he did it totally.
I say what, you know, it's kind of like with Jaws. Spielberg made Jaws. We've got to play a song in a minute, but we can talk about this for another half an hour, can't we? When Spielberg did Jaws, there were loads of Jaws knockoffs, but none of them, even the sequels, none of them had any of the magic that was Spielberg at that time. So Jaws is elevated by the fact that it's Steven Spielberg, whereas Richard Donner was in retrospect, and it wasn't until he died and I sort of like looked at his stuff and you look at his body, because I'm not walking around every day thinking about Richard Donner.
No.
And then all of a sudden he dies and then you look at his body of work and you go, oh my God, like I've never thought about it like this. But he nailed every genre and every film that he basically made. He didn't make tons, but the big ones that he made in the first two thirds of his career went on to define what everyone else would do with that genre afterwards. And it's kind of like you have Spielberg, who is Steven Spielberg, and he's like this magic elf that's turned up and he's made this film and no one can replicate what he does. But Richard Donner has kind of like gone, I've done it. These are the blueprints. All you need to do is watch that film and you can do it too. And it's kind of like you watch Lethal Weapon. There were so many clones from Lethal Weapon and some of them are as good as Lethal Weapon. And some of the sequels, well, I enjoy Lethal Weapon 2 as well. It's not as good as Lethal Weapon, but there are moments in it that are just as memorable, and the third one. And it's kind of like, you go, yeah, so Richard Donner kind of like made Superman and goes, this is how you do it. And then other people went like, great, he's cracked it. Let's just do that. And then with Lethal Weapon, it's like, this is how you do it. And with, you know, the Exorcist, he was just like, I'm trying to work out how to make that commercial. Because Exorcist was a big hit, but it was at the end of, it was at a point where the studios were taking back control over kind of like the maverick film directors of the 60s, 70s. Studios were taking back control, and sort of Richard Donner came along and he made this big, I mean, that's the difference, isn't it? I think Exorcist is almost an art house picture, and The Omen is a studio movie.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, he came along and he made these studio movies and he showed people how to do it. He was just great at it. Well, let's keep talking. Let's play a song.
Wake up, burn. long black hair. Then you change into an angel, blonde and fair. You can turn yourself blue and I don't care. You change your look, you can change your race, but it's always your touch and always your face. Daydreams, how you wanna do me. Daydreams, let me get through. Daydreams, ultra sensor body movie. There's a shot from my head to my fingertips. I fall through a hole cause I can't get a grip. The room starts to spin and the world starts to turn. My heart catches fire and my bed starts to burn. Daydreams, how you wanna do me. Daydreams, anything for you, babe. Daydreams, a realistic kid movie. Starring me and you. Make my dreams come true.
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back. We are talking about.
You've done yourself,
mate. We've talked about Richard Donner for about 25 minutes now. On top of that, I did a post about Richard Donner, and I said, well, he did The Omen, he did Superman, he did The Goonies, and I'm not a fan of Goonies at all, right? Mm-hmm. And he did Lethal. I can still appreciate the fact that I like the idea of Goonies. It's just so sort of like tied in with like a miserable time that I had. But he did The Goonies and he did Lethal Weapon. Those are his four big ones, right? Maybe the reason we don't think about Richard Donner so much, having said what I said before the song, is that there were so many knockoffs afterwards. And you kind of like go... And sequels, do you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, if you're going to watch a Superman film, do you watch Superman where it's half of it is set up and getting to know people? Like with Star Wars, it's like, if I was to watch any Star Wars film out of the 2.5 Star Wars films that I love, it would always be Empire Strikes Back, because it's right in the middle of the story. You're not one by one introducing all the characters. They're all there, right? So, and I think that maybe that's the thing where you kind of like, he did all of these incredible things that had never been done before.
Mm. I think you've already nailed it, though. I suspect it's because he's probably not appreciated because he worked very much in the mainstream in a way that the others felt like they were breaking into Hollywood. He feels like he's kind of part of it. He's kind of part of like the system. He doesn't feel like he's someone who's breaking in.
In person. even Spielberg followed up Jaws with Close Encounters, you know, and Close Encounters was an incredibly personal film, and Jaws was an incredibly personal film. And when you look at all of Spielberg's films, but we haven't done that with Richard Donner, you know, but when you look at all of Steven Spielberg's films, even though he's made a film about a shark and he's made a film about an alien, there's all of these things he's put in there about the family unit and relationships with your dad, you know, there's all of this stuff, and about divorce, and it's in all of his films throughout the 70s and 80s, and you kind of like go, yeah, he found a way of making a film about a shark into like a very personal, a studio film about a shark based on a book, into a film that was really personal to Steven Spielberg, you know. And I don't know if you look at all of the Richard Donner stuff that you go, he was making, he was smuggling in personal little indie movies into huge studio movies. But so I put on the post that he made those four films, Lethal Weapon, Goonies, Superman, and what's the other one, The Omen. And then also said, and I was also a massive fan of Scrooged, which I somehow watch every year. It's not a perfect film, but I'll watch Scrooged every year for Christmas.
I know lots of people that don't like it. I really like Scrooged. I think it's really funny. I think it's kind of, it's one of my favourite versions. I mean, it's hard to do a bad version of it now, I think, Christmas Carol. But I do love it. I do really love that film.
I don't love it. And I think, I remember watching it when it came out on video. We'll come back to this. So there was Maverick, Scrooge, and Assassins. I loved Maverick, and I only ever watched that on video. I grew up. It's a Christmas staple. Is Scrooge, and Assassins was one of the first kind of like movies that I went unaccompanied, I think. Mm. Or maybe I was 15 and it was a 15 and I was going to the cinema to watch sort of like the sort of movies that I would have to sneak around my mate's house and watch while he was out. And and then somebody wrote in and said, and Lady Hawk, don't forget Lady Hawk. And it's like, well, it'd be disingenuous of me to include Lady Hawk because it's in my list. Yeah. Then what you want to do is you want to do a post about Richard Donner, and you need to talk about how much you love Lady Hawk. I've never sat all the way through Lady Hawk, and it's kind of like one of them real worldy fantasy romances, which, you know, never really appealed to me when I was growing up because it wasn't Legend, and Legend is the weaker film, I imagine.
Yeah.
But it had all those visuals in it that kind of got you through, you know?
I regularly think to myself, I don't think I've ever seen Lady Hawk, and I regularly think to myself, oh, I should sit down and watch Lady Hawk, but I'm aware that I've had that thought for 10 or 15 years. You know what I mean? I've gone I should sit down and watch that at some point. Yeah, I should probably sit down and give that a go.
In a world where I've never seen Lady Hawk all the way through, it's kind of like, there's got to be a reason why I haven't. It just doesn't appear. Do you know what I mean? It's like the Fast and Furious in a way. It's just like, oh, although I'd rather see it than those. It's just kind of like, it just doesn't. It's something about a pre-Ferris Bueller Matthew Broderick. And there's something about a post-Ferris Bueller Matthew Broderick as well. It's something about Ferris Bueller and that's it. Maybe Election. But like, do you know what I mean? It's kind of, I don't know. So if you're thinking about whatever your favourite Richard Donner movie is, so Scrooged. Mm-hmm. I think Scrooge came out at a time when I was obsessed with, so it came out in 89, right?
89, I believe, yeah.
So that was the same year as Ghostbusters 2. Mm-hmm. Same year as Batman, Lethal Weapon 2. Did he do Lethal Weapon 2 and Scrooged in the same year? So he had a horrible time. He
maybe
had a horrible
Scrooged
time
was
Scrooged.
88. Yeah, maybe it's 88.
I think Scrooged was before, yeah, because
it was.
Wasn't it a thing? Wasn't the marketing was... So basically, Bill Murray made Ghostbusters, and he made part of his deal with making Ghostbusters was that he was big off Saturday Night Live. He'd done Meatballs, he'd done Stripes, He made, now which one was his film? He made Razor's Edge and Where the Buffalo Roam.
Where the Buffalo Roam.
So is Buffalo Roam his?
And in his, in what way? He's in it.
He's the one that produced it.
Yeah, I think so. That's the...
So he was... So is it Razor's Edge? Which one is the one where he's Hunter S. Thompson?
That's Where the Buffalo Roam.
So I think it was Razor's Edge then, wasn't it? Or maybe it was Where the Buffalo Roam. Basically,
he... Yes, I think you're right. I think Razor's Edge is the one that he made, off the back of...
So when he was doing... they were asking... Ghostbusters was written for John Belushi. John Belushi died, and then they needed to replace John Belushi. And if you didn't know any of this, Dan Aykroyd wrote the character of Slimer in Ghostbusters as a tribute to John Belushi. So when you see Slimer for the first time, he's eating loads of food and he's drinking loads of alcohol, and it's all passing through him when he's in the hotel. And basically, it's sort of meant to be John Belushi from Animal House. So they got Bill Murray to replace him, and Bill Murray was just like, I don't want to make Ghostbusters, I want to make Razor's Edge.
It's like a Somerset Maugham kind of adaptation, isn't it, or something.
And they were like going, great, well, and I think Dan Aykroyd said, well, this is how you get Razor's Edge made, and now it might be Buffalo Roam, but I think it's Razor's Edge. This is how you get Razor's Edge made, Bill. You sign up for Ghostbusters, and you say you'll only do Ghostbusters if you also get to make Razor's Edge. And Bill Murray said, great. But Bill Murray was like, I know these fuckers. They won't let me make Razor's Edge once I've made Ghostbusters. So he said, I will only make Ghostbusters if you let me make Razor's Edge first. So Bill Murray goes up, he makes Razor's Edge. And obviously it's before cell phones, but it's before, he just goes off into the fucking middle of nowhere and disappears off the face of the planet, makes this film. No one can get in contact with him. No one can get the script to him. And they all just assume that Bill Murray's not going to do Ghostbusters because, they're hoping he's going to turn up, but they're just like, well, he hasn't, he's not going to, we haven't heard from him. So Bill Murray locks himself in the edit. He edits the first cut of Razor's Edge. And once he's happy that the film is sort of like in progress, he turns up on the set of Ghostbusters. He hasn't read the script. He thinks Ghostbusters is going to be a pile of shit. And he makes Ghostbusters. And then halfway through making Ghostbusters, he realizes that Ghostbusters is not only going to be good, but is going to be do mega business. And all the way through the first half, he's sort of like being really disparaging, lazy. He can't be bothered to sort of like join in with everyone. And then because they filmed it in New York as well, and they were huge megastars in New York because of Saturday Night Live, whenever they've got a break in filming, everyone's asking for their autographs, and they're wearing the Ghostbusters uniforms, and there's Ecto-1, and Ghostbusters is basically marketing itself while they're making it, and they're megastars just walking around New York, and everyone's sort of like bombarding them. And then Bill Murray goes, ah, this is going to be great. And then halfway through filming Ghostbusters, he suddenly turns up for work every day and kicks in. And then he creates this, he was a popular comedian, and then he becomes a megastar. And then based on the success of Ghostbusters, he can't go anywhere and he hates it. So he moves to France with his family and disappears in France. And he goes away for a few years. And he didn't make any other films in the 80s. And then he did the cameo in Little Shop of Horrors.
For Rick Moranis, wasn't it? Because everyone loves Rick Moranis.
And Frank Oz. And I think it's this... And John Candy was in it. And it was kind of like All Good People, Steve Martin. All Saturday Night Live or the... what was the Canadian equivalent of that?
Oh, yeah.
SNTV.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe made up a couple of letters there, but you get the gist. And so he comes and does a cameo for that, but he hasn't, as a kid growing up in video shops, I just assumed that Bill Murray had done fucking loads and loads of stuff. And when you look back on it, it's like Al Pacino. He made like six films in the 80s. And then when he did Groundhog Day, which was Groundhog Day and What About Bob, which was sort of like his comeback movies, you kind of like go, well, these are his comeback movies. But they were comeback movies from like Ghostbusters, which was huge, Little Shop of Horrors, which everybody loved. And then he did Scrooge. And when Scrooge was there, they marketed the fuck out of it. Like, this is Bill Murray. Bill Murray is back. And he's brought some ghosts with him. And it's like, what, Christmas? It's a Christmas carol, right? Mm. But they're marketing it off it. Not, it's not Dickens. It's not a Christmas carol. This is like an unofficial sequel to Ghostbusters. It's Bill Murray and ghosts. What more could you want? And we've got them. Yeah, he had a horrible time making Scrooge with Richard Donner. Richard Donner hated making Scrooge okay. with Bill Murray. And then he made Ghostbusters 2, which he hated as well. And then he went into the 90s where he kind of did a couple of good films and then some really weird stuff like mm-hmm. Larger Than Life, Osmosis Jones, The Man Who Knew Too Little, which led him to Garfield, Space Jam, like some real... But going back to Richard Donner, so... yeah, so he kind of like made all of these different films, and when you put them side by side, they're just very, they don't feel like a consistent body of work. No. But then, because, you know, not like in a bad way, but you would just assume that the guy that directed The Omen was a different guy from the guy that directed Scrooged, was a different guy from the guy that directed Lethal Weapon. Yeah. And directed Goonies. Goonies is always a big surprise because it, although it's not, it feels like a Spielberg film because he produced it.
Or like Chris Columbus or that kind of. It's probably written by Columbus, isn't it? But like it's, it feels like it's one of those guys.
Does not feel like it. And then, so 20 years after he made Superman, they get him in to produce the X-Men films, or the first one at least. And then Lauren Shuler Donner, which was what, his wife?
Yeah, I think so. He was attached to X-Men for years, since like the early 90s. So that film was, it had a long pre-production. And I think he was attached to it kind of off the back of Superman. So they could say, yeah, it's like a superhero movie and Richard Donner's doing it, like Superman. So that had a long gestation period with him, was always attached as director. And I think at some point he was like, I'm not going to make this.
You know. But it was because Superman and Batman were both Warner Brothers and DC, and obviously Marvel were X-Men. So it was kind of like a different company that he was. But it seems so weird that it was 10 years between Superman and Batman, and then another 10 years between Batman and X-Men.
Well, weirdly, the only film that feels like a film you don't really associate with being in the same genre at all, but I think at the time it really was the film that kind of launched off the back of Superman was Popeye, because at the time people didn't talk about superheroes in the same way. They were like, what else is like, you know, like a cartoon character?
A comic book. Yeah.
So it was like that. So it's like Popeye, we'll get Popeye. That's finally going to get going off the back of Superman. And it's like, it wasn't those kind of things. And Batman again had a long gestation period. Because for a while that was Dante. Dante was doing it.
Well, there's loads of people that were doing it. And at one point it was Bill Murray as Batman. Mm. And another point it was Sam Raimi was up for directing Batman, and they wanted to get Bruce Campbell in as Bruce Wayne. And it's like, why didn't they make that? Mm. Sam Hamm had the script, didn't he?
And, there's different versions of the script. One of them is by the guy who was writing all the Bond movies, the sort of early Roger Moore Bond movies. But a lot of the early drafts of it were, like if they're doing a Batman movie, they were basically trying to do an update on the Adam West. So it wasn't really till the comics kind of went back a bit darker that they went, oh no, this is how we do Batman. So because to Hollywood, Adam West was Batman. So all the movie adaptations post-Superman were all like, how do we do a kind of very campy Batman film in the 70s? So they were kind of like, and 80s, I guess. So the idea was to do it like a comedy. Like, we'll do it, we'll get Bill Murray in because that's what Batman's like. It's a comedy.
But when Batman came out, the TV series was being repeated all the time on TV. So when you're a kid, you don't know that it was made in the 60s. You just think that this is the thing that... So when they made a film and you go, it's nothing like the... You know, it was like, does it say Blammo on the screen during Tim Burton's Batman? You go, no, it doesn't. What do you mean? Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like, it was mind-bending that the film was different from the TV series. Yeah. And then, it, you know. Anyway, so Richard Donner, amazing career. Contributed loads and loads to cinema. All of his films all of his earlier films, not even earlier films, I would say his later films leave something to be desired. But even something like Conspiracy Theory's got something good about it. He died on Monday, but I think everyone should watch a few of his films this week, and just remind, you know, without him, we wouldn't have a lot of stuff now.
I mean, and also, like, those Marvel movies are real kind of prototype based on Superman and things. Everything since is kind of based on Superman, isn't it?
It's amazing that Marvel have learnt more from Superman than DC.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Just like in terms of structure, how you introduce a character, all this stuff. You know, they did it. They go, oh, well, Iron Man was the blueprint. Yeah, no, Superman was the blueprint. And then Iron Man, every film after that has kind of done the same sort of, every origin movie since. Yeah. Anyway. So this,
let me just say this. The Superman movie also, that people don't acknowledge, is how much it influenced the comics of Superman. And so that, once they established the mythology in the movie, the mythology was all over the place before the movie. And as soon as they established it in the movie, they went, oh, yeah, that's it. That's how Superman became Superman. That's what happened. It like really cemented all the kind of the lore that was all over the place and silly, and really made it, condensed it into this kind of like sort of slick story that all made sense.
And Superman was this massive Warner Brothers, big budget, star-studded movie where they got proper actors in. And who wrote it?
Mario Puzo.
Or however you said it. And so one of the biggest influences on Superman was Godfather, really.
Yeah.
Which is, we'll get the guy that wrote The Godfather in to write Superman, and we'll get The Godfather in it, you know? And not only will we get The Godfather in it, but we will fill the film with, you know, character actors. And Gene Hackman is like one of the greatest actors of that time, and it's kind of like, we'll get Gene Hackman into, you know, and it's kind of like all like, what have we learned from studio pictures in the past, like The Godfather? It's kind of like, we'll go The Godfather approach and we'll treat it with the same sort of like reverence as that. And then The Godfather was kind of a trashy book that they upgraded.
Yeah.
And the same with Superman, they kind of like treated it like it was, you know, some sort of brilliant text. And not the funny papers. So, right, we're going to do some fan mail now before we get our guest on. Hello, five-star fan club. Thoroughly enjoyed your interview with TNG legend Marina Sirtis. And I am with you, Nick. ST6 is the best one. I rewatched it all in a row a while back. And it jumps out as being the most visually striking of the originals, despite the modest budget. Anyway, that discussion reminded me of the novelization of ST, the motion picture, written by Gene Roddenberry based on his pass at the script that,
for reasons that will become obvious.
Sometimes I wonder what it is that you're doing while I'm hosting our radio show now, or podcast. I sometimes wonder what it is that you are doing. Have one more stab at that, shall we?
Yes.
Anyway, that discussion reminded me of the novelization of ST, the motion picture written by Gene Roddenberry and based on his pass of the script that,
for reasons that could become obvious,
was not used. It is weirdly horny. Notable scenes include one where Mr. Spock is trying to meditate in a viewing chamber thing and keeps getting distracted by other crew members having noisy sex in the adjacent compartments. Best of all is a dilemma faced by Captain Kirk, who decides the only way to communicate with V'ger is by having sex with the Ilya probe, but is torn over who should do it. Decker, because of his past emotional connection with Ilya, or Kirk, because he is better at sex. Extraordinary scenes. Cheers, Toby. Is it Ilya? Am I reading it wrong?
I read it as Ilya.
Yeah.
Some fruity bits in the novelisation.
Thanks for sending that in, Toby. We prefer questions because it gives us something to work with, but that's a shame. You're basically saying that you listened to the show the other week and you agree with what we said and you've read a book. Can't stress this enough, guys. Don't worry about the first 55 minutes of the show. We've got that. But when it comes to that middle 5 minutes before we bring the guest on, that's you. That's over to you. And we can only make that work if you give us the material to springboard off, right? And in the last few weeks, I don't want to end the first half of this week's show with a telling off. Of course I don't. I'm the helmster. But, oh, God. But I'm just going to say, if you don't give us the material that we need in order to, you know, send the first half of the show off into the second half, then we can't do it properly. So please, we're begging you, keep that fan mail coming in, but make it good. Thank you very much. Sorry about that, Nat. I know that he agrees with me because he's nodding furiously as I'm saying this. Right, let's play a song and then let's get our guest on.
On FUBAR Radio.
And we're back live. We're not live, we're pre-recorded on a Wednesday, and we're back live in the studio. We're not live, pre-recorded on a Wednesday. We're not in the studio, I'm in my office and Nat is in his washroom. We're now joined by filmmaker extraordinaire Jamie Adams. Hello, Jamie.
How are you doing?
Wow. Good. Good. Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah, not bad.
Now, this is a bit of a delay. Is the delay the satellite link up from where we are to wherever you are, or is it the delay that you're taking a bit of time on answering?
I am in Cardiff, yeah, so maybe that's...
That's weird on Zoom. But All right. Well, right. So currently you are in you're in an editing suite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Directed or editing, presumably, another movie.
Hey, that's interesting. There's no delay with you, no?
Oh, hello. It's a wind up. What is the film you're working on currently, Jamie?
It's called Real Love, and it's a sham wedding comedy with Sean Clifford and Russell Tovey.
Oh, sweet!
Mm. Oh, and Nick Helm. Nick Helm's in there as well, actually.
So, when did we record that? In January, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the height of the pandemic. We were doing that in Marvin Park.
But that was January, right?
Yeah.
So, and so you're editing that now. How's that looking? This is like real time. This is two people that, so I made, so Love Spreads is out at the cinema now, and that we filmed that, what, I keep forgetting what year that we filmed that. We filmed that in 2017 or 18?
It was February 2018.
Right. And that was meant to come out at Tribeca last March, not last March, 2020, just as, and we were like booking our tickets to New York for the Tribeca Film Festival, weren't we? And looking for accommodation. So it's meant to come out then, but it's literally, it came out on the 19th, so just under a month ago, in America. And that sort of feels like it's been like a long gestation period. Is that typical for one of your productions or what?
I feel like this is like some kind of job interview.
Jamie, it is an interview and it is about your job. So how about pulling your fucking socks up and answering the fucking questions, yeah?
So what was your question?
I'm just going to say, right at the top of the show, Jamie, right? I'm putting my personal feelings aside right now, and I'm going to try and make the next 50 minutes as fucking professional as I possibly can, right? So tell us about the gestation period of one of your films, because we filmed Love Spreads, which has Isaac Gonzalez and Alia Shawkat. And that was the film that we made in 2018, and that's just come out.
Yeah.
And you're currently in Cardiff editing a film that we filmed in January this year.
Yes.
So what's the turnaround process of one of your productions, really?
I mean, it's normally quite swift, but I think that obviously what happened there was, number one, you've got to find the right festival. You can't just premiere, you know, anywhere. And we were very lucky with Tribeca for them to you know, they seemed to respond really well to Love Spreads, which was fantastic. And then, as you said, we were all ready to go. So actually, I suppose that is still quite long, because that would have been just over like a year and a half.
It would have been two years from when we filmed it to when it went to, because we filmed it over Valentine's Day in 2018.
Yeah, and then
it would have come out in March 2020.
But yeah, but we knew, you know, that you go into a festival about 6 months before. So I think for me, it's like, that's, yeah. So that's why we wait, is because you want to have the right festival to do that. But yeah, I knew 6 months before that we were going there. So that was, and then the pandemic hit, so we didn't do that. So yeah, so that, it does feel like a while ago. But actually, I've been constantly making films since. So for me, it's about the making of the film, getting to picture lock, as it's called, and feeling good about it. And then I move on to coming up with ideas for the next.
And so currently you're bringing out, you tend to have a film out a year, right? Going right back to your first one.
Yeah, I think there was one year where we had three out in the same year, which won't happen again. But yeah, so I mean, literally, they're low budget indie movies. So, you know, it's my craft, it's my job. So I need to keep moving forward and you know, keep making the films.
And what kind of budget, when you say low budget indie movie, what kind of budget? Do you know what? I'll tell you what, Jamie. When we have anyone that works in the industry on, we don't know them personally. So you have to sort of like, you know, pussyfoot around a little bit and you know, be polite and, you know, try and get out a bit of information. But we've worked with each other since 2018. We've done three films.
Yeah.
Two during the pandemic, and we also did a pilot for a TV series. So can we just sort of like talk to you a little bit about how you got started and then about the process of actually making a film?
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about kind of like doing what's the best way to describe you to the listeners is that you are a filmmaker, you're a director, you're a writer, you're a producer, you help other people make their films, and you kind of specialize basically in independent improvised movies, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And you generally manage to attract a pretty decent cast, and you kind of give actors an opportunity to do something that isn't a typical film. One of the things that attracts sort of like the bigger names that you get is the opportunity to do something that is a little bit off the beaten track, and you invite people to come along and improvise and not be kind of restricted or constricted with a screenplay. Yeah,
you know, totally, that's what it is. I mean, I get asked that quite a lot in terms of casting and in terms of how does that work? And generally people think that I'm friends with somebody who knows somebody and that's how that happens. But actually it's quite the usual way, really. But I think the difference with what I'm offering up is something that they would never get offered, which is, you know, it's an improvised movie. It shoots quickly. It shoots, you know, generally between 5 and 15 days. And so for them, they're kind of, I can only, you know, I'm not going to speak for them, but what I've heard is that they just think it's insane. They're just like, so we're going to make a feature film within, you know, 5 to 15 days. Normally, regularly, it's 6 days, and then sometimes it's 10 days. And I think once we've done 15 days.
When we did one in 2020, just before the pandemic hit, just while the pandemic was hitting, isn't it? We were very lucky to get it wrapped.
Yeah, like 2 weeks before.
And that was wasn't that a 4-day shoot or was it a 5-day shoot?
That was 5 days. And then they see the films. So as the films have gone on, so if, you know, they'll sit down and watch Black Mountain Poets, or they'll watch Benny and Jolene in the beginning, and they'll go, okay, so we do actually end up with a film, and they seem to enjoy them enough to go, let's go on this journey, let's be a part of this experience.
One of the things that people ask me when I say what I've been up to is they say, what do you mean it's improvised? And it's not, I mean, it is improvised, but it's not so much, it's not like from scratch. You don't like invite a bunch of actors and say, well, right, what's this going to be about?
That's interesting though, isn't it? I quite like that idea.
Don't do that, Jamie. Stressful enough, just as it is.
No, I mean, literally it's developed, you know, it developed over the first three films, really. We found, I mean, Joe Swanberg and the Duplass brothers and Lynn Shelton and all the, what they like to call the mumblecore generation, they got fellow actors together and created movies out of desperation to make films because no one else was giving them the opportunity. And, you know, thankfully, you know, through being so gracious, they were in email contact with me, and I talked through kind of how I was thinking of making movies and you know, what was possible over here. And we, through that, I stumbled across this kind of idea that we could follow the Joe Swanberg type method of, you know, having scenes that we knew we were going to shoot. But at that time, there was only like one line for each scene. And I knew I just wanted to get a bunch of really talented people on the road. So we just, it was like, I think I'm a frustrated drummer in a band, basically. So I was like, how do we get on the road? What's this story? Well, it's just going to be a road movie. It's about music. And through that came up with Benny and Jolene. So it was essentially two motorhomes full of like, I think it was like seven people in each. And then like, I think like one or two cars. And we traveled down to London. We traveled up to North Wales, went through McCunclough. We came out of South Wales. And I think that was only 5 days. There was a lot of driving involved. And after the first day, one of the actors was like, we probably shouldn't be filming whilst we're on the road. So we didn't after that. So we did lose quite a bit of time, but we still had a lot of incredible locations and incredible scenes. But it did feel a bit like sketch comedy in terms of this is the location and this is this moment, but it didn't feel very sort of narrative driven. And so for the next one, we made sure that what I had written down for the scenes became just progressed. There was more for the actors and in fact, more for the crew. That was the other major thing was that, you know, actors generally are there to jump in and try and do the best they can with what's in front of them. But crew were getting frustrated because they didn't really have much of an idea of what the scenes were going to be and how to prepare for them. So yeah, with A Wonderful Christmas Time, it progressed. And then with Black Mountain Poets, it became almost a screenplay, but without dialogue, or at least, you know, there'd be some dialogue, but not dialogue that I expected anybody to learn and follow. And that's basically what's been since then.
Black Mountain Poets is basically, it's high concepts in terms of what the film is. Do you know what I mean? You could describe that in like one sentence. So go on.
I'm not great at the one sentence thing.
No. But like, so Black Mountain Poets is two criminals go on the run and they hide out at a poetry retreat, and every day they're forced to come up with improvised poetry or poetry. I remember when I saw that, I was kind of like, so which part of it is improvised then? Because the poems that the group come out with feel like they must be scripted, obviously. But they weren't, right?
No, they weren't. No, I mean, essentially, have you seen Black Mountain Poets, Nat?
No, I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen it.
So, I think there's two or three sort of improv poetry moments in it where they have to get up and they have to deliver these poems. And we had three professional poets. Are poets professional? Anyway, we had three professional poets there, and they were going to be in the film, but we actually figured out pretty soon that you could tell which ones were the actors and which ones were the poets. And so what they ended up doing was actually helping the actors with the writing of these poems. And I mean, the first set of poems anyway, it was meant to be like an improv moment at this retreat. So they weren't meant to be fantastic poems. And so everyone pretty much didn't have time to even think. I didn't tell them what was coming. And then I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. And then Roger Evans, in his character, asks them one by one to come up and you know, deliver a poem about their trip, their journey to the retreat. They were amazing. So they were some of the best poems, completely just improvising the moment. I remember Richard Ellis, who I work with quite a lot, he basically just came up with what happened to him on his journey to the film. So in terms of his car apparently slid a little bit on like a wet patch in the road. It was quite heavy rain getting up to the Black Mountains of Wales. And so, yeah, he used that moment, but he was quite clever. He did it in English and it was only like three lines, and then he just repeated it in Welsh. And so it felt like there was more to it. But yeah, so in terms of Black Mountain Poets, no, none of the, I mean, I think for the last poems, Alice and Dolly went and wrote those. But for the middle poem, in fact, the receipt poem.
I mean, I was going to say that is the bit where you go, well, that's got to be scripted, right?
No. So what happened, just very quickly, is that we were shooting the scene, and all we knew is that this was going to be the middle poem moment, where what we'd learnt about them so far, they were going to talk about in these poems. And Alice had decided to stand in opposition to the rest of the poets. So they were all in a sort of semicircle, and she was almost on stage in front of them. And she, in character, she was getting frustrated with these poets and what they thought was poetry. And so she said something about, you know, I could deliver a receipt better than your poems. And they say, go on then. And it's at that moment that I go, okay, hold it there. And I go, who's got a receipt? And then somebody came up with this receipt, and I was like, okay, this is your poem, Alice, away you go. And we're still filming, you know, we're still turning. I don't really say cut much. And she just had to run with it, and she'd never read the receipt before. She didn't know what was coming. And she delivered an incredible moment in the film.
I guess that's what improv is, isn't it? It's something happening in the moment that someone is able to kind of leap on and take advantage of something. So there's that, which I guess is also what your job is as director. It's your job to step in and say, that's a great idea, let's run with this.
It's guiding, essentially, because what's happening in front of you is really talented people giving their all to whatever that whim or moment is. And I often say at the beginning, when you hear my voice, because I say hold it there, or I say wind it back quite a bit, and I try and remind them of what moment I want by saying a line or something that they've just said, so they at least know where they're going from. But yeah, I don't try to, and I offer up things, and that's the point at which I go, you don't have to do what I've just said. You don't have to go, you know, I say something like, okay, now start speaking about your uncle and whilst making a cup of tea. You know, they might they'll hear it, and they don't have to follow that.
Yeah,
they can decide to ignore me.
When we were filming, and you said do a Jamaican accent.
Yes. Yeah.
And I turned to you and I told you to fuck off.
your eyes told me that first, and then and then I asked you to do it again, and then you told me to fuck off. But yeah, because some. But it's all gathering material, and like, in fact, I did that with Dan Clark. We were shooting a scene on Wild Honey Pie, and Dan just wasn't understanding the scene. He didn't get what was happening, and he really wanted to talk it through. He really wanted to talk more about what we were doing, and I could see that everyone else was firing. And I was like, if we stop it now and start talking about what's going on here, so that Dan's up to speed with everybody else, then we're going to lose the energy of what's going on here. And so I said, okay, Dan, don't worry about any of that. But this time, whatever you do, say it in a Liverpudlian accent. and it just immediately gives him a whole new energy, where he's just like, okay, I was confused before. Now I'm absolutely, I have no idea why I'm doing a Liverpudlian accent. And I say action, and away he goes. And it's some of the funniest stuff from Dan in the film, because he's so confused. He's just like, I don't know why I'm trying a Liverpudlian accent. I don't know where I'm meant to be or what I'm doing, and it's confusing. It is right for the character.
And what are the economic? I mean, cause it's difficult in this country. You've kind of got budgets can seem to go from what would be a big budget in the UK, which is probably a fraction of what big Hollywood movies cost, that go from sort of a kind of medium budget movie to ultra low budget, no budget movie. But what you're making, I'm always hard to get trying to get my head around, like, well, how much would this have cost, and what are the economics of it? And is that, essentially, how much do you have to earn back? Are you working with producers who are funding it, or is it all, how does it all work? How do you kind of get the money for these films?
Yeah, as soon as anybody can tell me that, then I'd know what the magic is. All I do is make sure that I have lots of great ideas, what I consider great. Anyway, Nick doesn't like half of them. But I have whatever I consider to be good ideas, and I send them. I send out the best sort of three or four to in a what I call a lookbook, which is essentially a story outline. Keep it short; people haven't got time, and just get to the point of why this is a saleable story. And then I say, you know, what I've done, and I say who I imagine will be involved. And what I can make it for. And generally that figure is anywhere from 25,000 to 500,000. And the conversations that go on once somebody likes the idea is then that the budget is based on, you know, what the idea is. So for Songbird, that was quite an easy sort of sell in terms of it's a faded Britpop star. Female Britpop star who doesn't want the good times to end, so she goes to university. So it felt like a Will Ferrell kind of film in terms of it's quite a high concept thing and really needed £10 million to pull it off, you know, to that extent. So I said it's an indie version of that with Kobe Smulders in the Will Ferrell role and, you know, Jessica Hines in support and... Yeah, I mean, Richard Ellis is back, and yeah, it's an incredible. I mean, Daisy Haggard was in that film as well. It's an incredible cast, and they run the numbers. They go, what do we think? If this film is just awful, then we'll still be able to sell it on the poster and the people involved. So, what do you reckon we can get for that? And then they'll come back to me with a figure. And I'll say whether or not I can do it for that.
Right. I guess 2020 is kind of a, we don't know what's happening with films now. But in terms of that, how are they thinking of selling it? Is it kind of that...
You can't ever second guess any of that.
Right.
There's no knowing about who these people are going to be in the end. Like, you can imagine some people you're going to send these things to and go, oh, they've you know, like the Fisherman's Friends people at the moment, for example, they're probably getting sent a ton of things because they made millions of pounds with that film.
Right.
You know, and there's no knowing if one of those producers, I think there's three or four in that film, they might pick up on an idea that they get sent out of the hundreds that probably get sent their way. And they'll go, oh, you know what? I really wanted to work with that actor before. And they'll do it for that reason. Or they'll do it for... oh, you know, it's a high concept. That will sell on its own, you know. And then they'll just pick us, you know, you never know. I think for all my films, only the first three did I really know who's going to fund them.
Right.
Out of the others, I've just looked around, you know, and just kind of been smart with who, I'm not being arrogant, but you've got to be smart in terms of you can't just send it out to, you know, the Bond producers or whoever it is. You have to think who's going to be interested to go on this kind of journey. What would they get out of it? Because that's all anybody is really looking for. If they're going to spend even £30,000-£40,000 is a hell of a lot of money. So, like, what are they going to get out of it? You know, and you know, at that level, they should, anything up to 250,000, they should get their money back if the idea is good.
Mm.
And if the main cast involved, you know, are popular, then that it shouldn't be too much of a, and then it just comes down to scheduling. Then it can come down to whether or not they've got time to do it. So there are plenty of people out there with money, plenty of indie financiers with money, but it comes down to, like, have they already got loads on their slate? Have they already got something like what you're pitching, you know? And the other thing with my films is that they can go really quickly. So if I'm sending this out in say April, I can shoot it in June or July. So that doesn't normally happen. It normally takes at least, you know, 6 months to a year, even on a very low budget thing, before something turns around into production.
And in those terms,
sorry. But just on all of the projects that I've worked on, you feel like they've been put together in very different ways. So we've done three films and one TV, was it a pilot for BBC yeah. Wales?
Yeah.
And so the BBC Wales one was kind of like, obviously you, I don't know, how much money did you get for that?
Oh, that's titchy. That was really small because it wasn't meant to be for broadcast. That was meant to be a sort of web series idea, really. They were trying to, BBC Wales were trying to get their sort of people to go onto their website, the iPlayer for Wales. I can't remember what it's called. But it's not the normal, it's not the general iPlayer. It's something to do with Wales. And so, yeah, God, I mean, literally we only had like, I mean, it was low. I think it was like $7,000 for two of them. But it was very, very low. And they were meant, and for that reason, that they were then meant to be picked up for a pilot for broadcast. But instead, because they saw what we did was, they really thought it was, you know, broadcastable, that they, I said, fine, yeah, broadcast it. So
what? Well, I know that from working with BBC on something like Uncle, when we did the first series of that, they were like, hey, that's great. And you know, I think everyone puts in a little bit, on a small budget, everyone puts in a little bit of extra work, like the art department and the costume, and everyone really wants it to work well. And I think I got paid per song on Uncle. And so they wanted six songs, but they could only afford four songs. And I said, well, I'll do a fifth song for free. I think it was the last series. So I was like writing stuff for free because it would make more sense to have a song there than it would to not. And I didn't want money to be the thing. But what tends to happen is once you prove how much work you can do on no money, because you go, I think as an artist, you go, look at what we did with no money.
Yeah.
If you give us some money, we could do it even better. And their mentality is, well, you did a really good job with no money. Let's see how you can do with less money. And then you go, oh, right. And so the opposite
yeah.
tends to happen.
Well, no, I mean, that was the way this all started, though, is that I found out that Le Duncan Scorsese, which is the Shea Meadows film, which I really love, I know that was made for $50,000. And then somebody told me that, of course, what's on screen didn't cost $50,000 because Shane and Paddy need to be paid for their time. And I think Olivia Colman was in it and so on. So I figured out that it probably could have, because that was shot over 5 days. I was like, that probably could have been made for $20,000 to $25,000 if you call in a lot of favours in post-production. And then I remembered El Mariachi and Robert Rodriguez making El Mariachi as a, yeah, but it was like a, look what I can do for that amount of money and then give me the actual budget now so we can go make it better. So I thought with Benny and Jolene, which is actually called Jolene, the Indie Folk Star Movie, which I thought was quite a funny title. we thought that we'd show somebody that and then they'd go, well, this is kind of cool. Do you want a decent budget to go make it, you know, over 24 days, which is your ideal, or has been told over the years, your ideal indie sort of schedule. And they didn't do that. Instead, I found myself, Verve Pictures picked it up to distribute it. And I found myself on the stage at NFT1, sold out at Loco Film Festival. And I was there just going, this feels odd. This wasn't meant to be my first film, wasn't meant to be one that I know is compromised in so many ways, but I felt grateful, but I was also like, it doesn't make any sense to me that this is what's, and people paid like £16 a ticket. I felt like a phony. I felt like an imposter. I was like, this is not meant to be the debut film, but you know, it did kick off then what I understood to be this process of, I'm a working class lad from, you know, my parents were like pub landlords. So, and I still live in Wales with my family and my three children. So, you know, for me to be there on that stage with a film that I'd made, I was like, well, that's got to be what I always hoped would happen, isn't it? So I realized that there is no one way, which is obviously what film school teaches you. There's a way of becoming a filmmaker. There's, you know, you wait in line at the BFI until they say that they're ready. That you can, there are other ways. And then for me, there had to be another way. And that's what I just continued to do.
And that's it. You've just kind of, is that the best advice you could give, is to just do it?
It depends completely on who you are and what your end goal is. you know.
So you seem to understand that world in a way that when you're talking about it, I guess there is a world to know about, right? So if you're like, so when you're talking about distributors and who you send it to, you have, it, you, you know, your first one was 2014. So you guess you've had 7 years now of kind of feeling out the business and I guess knowing producers or distributors that you can go, I'll approach them. Is that part of it, just knowing the world and who exists in it?
Yeah, but I mean, I was like 15 when I started making short films and, you know, from, I didn't realize I had OCD at the time, but I was making lists every day of like who the people are that are making films in Britain specifically. And joining the dots of like, well, who works with who and why is that happening and who's involved in funding them. So it's years of research to get to the point to get to the point of being able to call in the favors on Benny and Jolene. I mean, I did a web series before that, and I was assistant editor with some great editors on some, you know, I did State of Play with Justine Wright over here, the part that they did over here, and the producers that were in that room. And then, I mean, it's Kevin MacDonald was in that room. And so it's just overhearing all these, I mean, Barry Mendel did God Help the Girl, and Barry Mendel produces Judd Apatow films. And so I was up in Scotland, kind of working as an assistant editor. And in the cutting room, you're always able to ask questions. You're always, there's always time to be able to talk to, they're not as pressured in that environment. And he watched a few of my short films and gave me the confidence to take it to the next level and make a low budget feature. And yeah, so I mean, there's all of, yeah, it's never an overnight thing, right? It's like, it's a long, long time of just a lot of research and a lot of just, you know, it's the apprenticeship of taking note on how the world works, how that world works in, specifically.
That's fascinating. And so how do you live? Like, is it, because I guess that's the thing about, you're not going to have like, you're not going to be ultra rich from doing this, but is it also that you're mixing kind of making your own movies with sort of more commercial work that you do alongside it?
No, it's, I mean, a couple of years ago, I was asked if I wanted to do certain television, and when the children were younger, it was easier for me to say no. I've done a couple of pilots. I did the Tim Renko pilot, which I really enjoyed.
Right.
And I didn't want to do the series when I heard where they were taking it. Apparently our pilot, which was the only one that got picked up that year, was too filmic, which I never understand that kind of terminology, especially when you look at what's happening now with television.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've done a few of those, and you know, I like second unit directing on television, and I could, you know, if it was something that I felt like, for example, Love, the show with Gillian Jacobs on Netflix, that kind of show, I could, that's, you know, if I was asked if I wanted to direct that, I'd be like, yes, because I could see how it would be something that I would have written or that I would have, you know, generated in some respects. So anything that is linked to me that I am interested in. But I'm old. I'm a traditionalist in lots of ways, and I love the idea that if you're a filmmaker, you're a filmmaker, and that's what you are, and that's what I've been doing. And as long as I can keep that going, then I'm happy with that. But no, in terms of, I live, you know, in a terraced house in a small coastal town in South Wales with my three children and my wife, and you know, we're renters, we can't buy anything, but we're invested as a family, well, the kids don't have a choice, my wife does, in me expressing myself in this way and continuing along this path. And we've only come close once over the years to it being a case of, okay, well, you now have to choose to be a lecturer at a university or try and carry on. And it literally came down to weeks, you know, where I'd applied for some of this, was about 5 years ago, and then I got the money to make another film. So yeah, it's hair raising. It's certainly not great for the heart in terms of when you're looking for a project to take off. But once it is taking off, then of course it's the best thing for the type of person that I am.
And so some of the am I right in thinking that some of the projects even that we've done, some of them come from you with the story, and you've gone, I want to tell this story, and this is the best way to tell the story. And some of them have come from there being money available, and you going, right, there's money, we can make a film. What are the components that we've got at hand to make the film, and what's it going to be about? So sometimes it's story to screen, and sometimes it's availability and finance available, and then you fill that requirement, yeah?
Most of the time, most of the time it's ideas first, and then, you know, if a financier is interested in, I mean, I can't again speak for them, but what I imagine they do is they go, well, we can make this very quickly with these people involved, which means we can already assume that we're going to be able to get this amount of money back and more. And it'll be a great journey to go on. Maybe because they think about working with me again, or which has happened, or maybe it's about the actors involved, and about what they would like, how they would like to get to know them for other projects. But mostly it's been that. I think only once has it been the money's there, what am I going to do now? And I think that was Love Spreads, actually, because I had a situation with a financier where, you know, as long as I think I had to make something like 3 films a year, but I could produce, you know, they didn't want to be directed by me, they could be produced as well by me. And yeah, interestingly, Love Spreads was an amalgamation of about 4 or 5 ideas I've had since university, that no one will finance that story about a girl group who are struggling to write their second album. That's not a story that, you know, they're going to be able to type into a computer and they're going to say, oh yeah, this is going to earn loads of money. So that money already existed, and they were as soon as they knew what cast was going to be involved, they were like, that's fine. But that was a time where the money existed before. And I think that's why I was quite adventurous it's not adventurous, is it? But I was quite sort of, well, this is the one time I don't have to think of a high concept, or think of the story has to be likable even. It's like, what is it that I want to say right now? And mm-hmm. I was quite blocked. I was quite frustrated, and so I was able to tell the solipsistic story about an artist who can't write, which turned out actually to be one of my most personal films, and one that people have really connected with in America anyway, where it's come out.
So with Love Spreads, that's what we met on. So the way that I got brought onto that was, I guess we've got mutual friends. But you messaged me on Facebook and you said that you had seen, and this is what won me over, was that you didn't even mention Uncle. You said that you'd seen my short film Elephant, and you said, would you like to do this thing? And then I was like, okay, what is it? And so I watched Black Mountain Poets, and then I got in contact with Alice Lowe and Brett Goldstein, because they'd worked with you in the past. I don't think I got in contact with Daisy. Maybe I texted Daisy. And I said, what's it like working with Jamie? And everyone said...
You don't have to go into what they said if you don't want
to. I will. No, I won't go into the real nasty stuff. But,
you vetted me, and then, right, yeah.
I asked, because it was sort of like...
I understand.
It's like, hey, do you want to be in a movie? And you go, yeah. Do you want to be in an improvised movie? Ah. and I was like, what's it like? And they all said, well, it's mental. And what you essentially have to do, I think Brett was the best at describing it. Alice was just like, you have to just kind of go along with it. Brett was like, you'll resist it, you'll fight against it, but eventually you just need to give in and let Jamie be in control and just let go of like all of your ego and your preconceived ideas of what it is. So when I agreed, then you sent over a scriptment, which I've learned since is a term that no one else uses. I say in meetings, we'll do a scriptment. And people go, what's a scriptment? And then they'll go, that's an amazing idea. And you go, yeah, it's pretty cool, right? And
I'm pleased because I was just thinking, what's a scriptment? But yeah, scriptment,
it's good. It's a cross between a treatment, where you basically do a blow-by-blow of what the film's about, and a script where... And Jamie wrote, I think it was about 50 pages. And it's a 50-page scriptment where it basically takes you character by character, scene by scene, through the entire film. And every so often, if there's an important bit of dialogue in there, then he'll write out. But it'll be like five lines or something in the middle of a page. And so I read it and I was like, okay, right, and who else? And I Googled everyone else that was in it. I was like, yeah, okay, cool, I'd love to do this. And then you go out there, and then on day one, my character was a very specific character in Love Spreads. And in day one, scene one, action. And because of the way it was, improvised, it became clear that I couldn't do the character that I'd been hired to do because the way I was going to do it was kind of like dictated to by the way other people were treating my character. Other characters were treating my character, and it was just like, well, I can't do it that way. So even with something that had it's a 90-minute film, and so... You really want a 90, if it was a script, it would be a 90-page script. But we had a 50-page scriptment. And so even fundamentally, in terms of the character that I'd signed on to play, as soon as I got there, you go, right, if we stick to this scriptment, we've got a film. But on the very first scene, it was like, that was thrown out the window. And you go, oh, right. So it's not completely improvised. And there is a plan. But even with a plan that was pretty detailed, you know, it was over half the page numbers that you need to do. It's like generally it's a page a minute. And so it was like 50 pages. You go, that's pretty good. But even with something that was as detailed as that, it was kind of like, oh, right, it can all change. You know, there was kind of like a lot of like weaving in and out of kind of like what you had planned. You know, you brought on actors that weren't in the original scripts, in the original document, to sort of like take other characters in different directions and to give people kind of like backstory and things like that.
Yeah, so keep it fresh, you know. It was all about keeping it fresh.
So there's a plan, and you know kind of what the film's going to make, but if a scene turns out differently as you're doing it, well, when we did what's the one that you're editing now? Real Love.
Real Love, yeah.
That was one thing, wasn't it? It was basically a film about a wedding reception.
It was. They were going to be locked in. You're going to be locked in for the weekend.
It was a film about a bunch of people that go to a wedding, including me and Richard Herring, we have the wedding, and then at the end of the wedding we get locked into the church, and then the film is about all of the guests of this wedding that are trapped in this place, and it's a romantic comedy. And then on day one you realize that you didn't want to make that film, so you rewrote it on the first night, and then we all turned up and we were like, oh, right, we're extras.
that's so funny.
We're colours on your palette, and if you need to use us that day, you'll go, oh, we need a bit of purple, so we'll bring...
Yeah. You know, what happened there was the grandiose ideas that, you know, we have when you're just in a room on your own and you're going, this is what's going to happen and that'll be great. And then you get there and you remind yourself, oh, actually, it takes a long time to you know, get what you need from the improv, let alone be able to cover something like 11 characters that we had for that film. It was always a bit kind of, I think I just really wanted to be around some really cool people for a bit because the pandemic annoyed me.
And me, I was there.
And I was like, you know, but then I started to, we rushed the wedding so much that when I, because, you know, my DOP is like, Jamie, I can't move any quicker than I am. And I was like, we've only covered about 4 people in that wedding and not very well. So I was like, well, we have to redo the wedding. And then I was like, we just need to make this easier on ourselves and make it about the build up to the wedding and then have the wedding and then have a bit of the reception. So within the 5 days, we actually had a much more manageable story to tell rather than, you know.
Within one day, you had a much more manageable story. You know, day one, it was like we're all in the wedding and we're filming a wedding. And then on day two, we'll film something else. But then you went away, thought about it. And on day two, we go, well, we're filming that wedding again. We kind of nailed it yesterday, right? And then you kind of like go, all right. But I'm not saying this as a negative. I'm saying this as like, it's great to be able to get the money together, to get a cast together, to have people there that are there in support of what you want to do. And we all have a plan, but it's also great to be able to throw that plan out. Not great for me, obviously. I spent a lot of sitting around. But then I made some friends for life in that green room. It was great.
Yeah, sure.
But you know what I mean? It's great to be able to sort of like go, this is the plan. And then, you know, take a tangent and go, actually, we're going to make it about this now.
Yeah, I mean, with Love Spreads was interesting because that was one of those moments where characters were doing things that I didn't expect. And so you can't say no. You're there to guide. You're not there to dictate. Otherwise, just write the screenplay. So, you know, we even got to a point where I didn't even look at the scriptment from about day 3 or 4. That was a 10-day shoot. On day 3 and 4, I just basically started writing the scenes that we were going to do the next day, the night before. So it became very driven. by what had happened that day and what I needed to move things forward the next day. Sometimes like Black Mountain Poets, that didn't veer off the scriptment very much. And then there's other times like Love Spreads where, yeah, it becomes something very different. But we found something really beautiful with the ending of Love Spreads. I'm really glad audiences have picked up on that and feel that as well. I mean, that wasn't at all, you know, your character wasn't at all, that wasn't his arc. And then it developed and became what it was. And it's really, you know, it's really affecting, actually. So yeah, I'm really pleased.
But real love changed very dramatically from what we were, you know, hoodwinked into signing up for to what it ended up becoming. But Love Spreads, I think overall it was the film that we all sort of signed up for, but I think specifics like characters and motivation, that changed daily. And the other thing was that it was a 10-day shoot, wasn't it? But we were there for 11 days because we had one day off in the middle, right?
Yeah.
In my head, I'm always like, it was 11 days, but it was actually 10, yeah.
Yeah, and we got there the day before, so maybe it's 12.
Why do you always work with comedians?
I ask myself that question all the time. Because they're more depressed than me. Maybe that's it. In honesty, they're just the most smart and able people to come up with ingenious new directions for scenes in the moment. I mean, I guess stand-up is the most terrifying thing. I've never done it, never will do it. I'm very shy. So seeing these, like Nick, just why are they getting up there? Why are they doing that to themselves? I love that kind of person. They're throwing themselves in at the deep end. And, you know, if they survive, then they get to continue. And they're not afraid of failing. And I think that that's why comedians are brilliant in this environment, because, you know, they kind of show actors, because I mix, you know, you mix the actors with the comedians. And in fact, they cross over a lot of the time as well. But it basically puts everyone at ease, because then as soon as you see someone, I mean, like Richard Ellis, I think he's as much of a comedian as he is an actor. He won't like me for saying that, but that's how I view him. And so he will just try anything. Like, you know, we'll just mention something and he'll just go with it. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it's like, okay, well, let's do something else. And it's not like, there's no embarrassment or, you know, there's nowhere to hide for a kickoff. So you might as well just try something. And if it doesn't work, we can just go again. It's not theatre.
That's one of the things when you're working with actors as well, is kind of like, you've got to stop resisting the process and you have to just do it. And it's difficult.
Yeah, and I think that's awesome. Most of my films are comedies, Nat. And you know, another thing is that comedians are great writers. And so you surround yourself with, you know, very talented comics who have got that courage to just throw themselves into something. But as Nick, you know, kind of pointed or alluded to earlier, you know, it's also the comics that will say no to something as well, rather than, you know, actors are trained to say yes. You know, and so comics would just, they have a very distinct, very quick ability. They have to think on their feet, I imagine, being on that stage in that sort of environment. I hate talking about something I don't really know about, but I guess that's what it is. And so they're just much, and also knowing that we are moving a narrative forward here. So not just being funny for the sake of it, of also thinking, well, also I'm in this, doing this, and then we need to go there. And so, yeah, they're just very smart people and very.
It's a good mix as well. We've got to wrap up soon, but it's a good mix, because what you basically have is you have, like, people like Richard came on Love Spreads and I'd never done it before. And so you've got more experienced people that are guiding other people on your projects and saying, well, it's always like this, which puts you at ease. It's also comedians working with actors, actors working with comedians. So the comedians are acting more and the actors being sort of like led down a path to be more funny. And so everyone sort of compliments each other on one of those sets. It's really great.
That's the ideal.
It's really great what you're doing, and I've enjoyed working with you so far.
Thanks, so far.
we've got to wrap up. Nat, we've got 3 minutes. Okay, can you do this?
Yeah, we can do it.
We've got 3 minutes. So, Jamie, unfortunately, I've got to hand you over to Nathaniel now, and we're going to play the internationally world-famous game, Better or Worse.
Now, Jamie, in this game, you have to say whether the next person is better or worse to score points, but using my opinion to do so. So beginning with...
Again, Vincent 3 minutes. You've got 3 minutes now.
Vincent Price. Is Adam West better or worse than Vincent Price, based on my opinion?
Better.
Yeah, I think he might be better. Phil Collins, better or worse than Adam West?
Worse.
Better.
Worse.
Come on.
Peter Sellers, better or worse than Phil Collins?
Better. Worse.
Better.
Did on purpose.
Tony Curtis, better or worse than Peter Sellers?
Better.
Worse.
Yeah, I'm doing well.
Orson Welles, better or worse than Tony Curtis?
Better.
Better.
Better. Roy Scheider, better or worse than Orson Welles?
Better.
Worse.
I think worse. Richard Attenborough, better or worse than Roy Scheider?
Better.
Worse.
Better. Gene Hackman, better or worse than Richard Attenborough?
Better.
Better. Robin Williams, better or worse than Gene Hackman?
Worse.
Worse.
Worse. Bono, better or worse than Robin Williams?
Worse.
What's the score? Six.
You're six. You got a surprisingly high six there, Jamie, because fucking hell, I thought that was atrocious. You got a at 6, which is good. It means that you're not quite as good as Dane Baptiste. Marina Sirtis with 9. Kyle Gass, you're as good as Kyle Gass with 6, and you're better than Sarah Gibbs with 5. Great.
Yeah,
Jamie, lovely. Thank you for coming
on
the
show. Thank you for coming on, Jamie.
You're welcome back here anytime. Welcome to the clubhouse. That's a goodbye from me.
And a goodbye from me. Thank you, Jamie.
No problem.
And Jamie, it's a goodbye from...
from me in Cardiff.
Yeah, great. Thanks, everyone. Look after yourself. We're nearly out of it. And well done, England, for winning. Commiserations to England for losing. It's a pre-record. Great. I'll see you. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.